We're pleased to have with us today Merrill Kempfert. His education began in college at Concordia College in St. Paul, Minnesota, and then he matriculated to Concordia Senior College in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and then to Concordia Seminary. He graduated from Concordia Seminary with his Master of Divinity in 1968. And at that time, he was assigned his first call to St. Paul's Lutheran Church, Eden Valley, and Gloria Dei Lutheran Church, Cold Springs, Minnesota. During the summer of 1970, he began with clinical pastoral education. And then after two more years in the parish, he did a residency, a one-year residency in clinical pastoral education at the Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. From that time, he began his work apart from the parish at Willmar State Hospital, where he served there as the Protestant chaplain, working with the chemically dependent, mentally ill, and developmentally disabled. Then he continued his work as chaplain and counselor at the Alcoholism Treatment Center on the campus of the Lutheran General Hospital, Park Ridge, Illinois, beginning in 1977. In 1981, he was transferred to Parkside Lodge of Mundelein, where he served the inpatient detoxification and outpatient units. In 1989, he assumed the position of executive director of Parkside Lutheran Hospital, an 88-bed specialty hospital on the campus of Lutheran General Hospital, serving those with chemical dependency, eating disorders, psychiatric problems, and issues of older adults. In January of this year, he assumed the position of director of Congregational Services for Parkside Medical Services Corporation, an alcoholism network for the Lutheran General Health Care System. And since 1982, he has served as a member of the Task Force on Alcohol and Substance Abuse for the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. He is truly an expert in his field, and today he will speak on the spiritual dynamics of addiction. We welcome Merrill Kempfert.
To you, since you're not going to come to me, all right? So I'm going to forget about the microphones so the audio people are on their own. I love it when these introductions are made because I sound so important. I mean, it's just incredible. I'm just a little student that graduated from the STEM back in 68, and that God has been very gracious to me in these ensuing years. I want to give you credit for two things today. One is, Dean Smith shared with me the all-time low attendance record is 5. So I said, if we get 6, I'll feel very grateful. We met that goal. I give you credit. The beautiful day, the humidity hasn't set in. You're on your way, for many of you, on your calls and wrapping up the end of a school year. So to come today, I give you credit. Secondly, when you hear about the topic of addiction, usually it's the last topic anybody wants to come to, because if I show up here, maybe it implies I may have a problem, or somebody I know, so God forbid I should show up at a place like this. So I give you credit for two things. Yesterday, part of the reason I'm here is for 2 days at headquarters, church headquarters, our task force met, and as we discussed a number of issues facing the church related to addictions, I let them know that I'd be coming to the seminar today. I changed what I was going to be doing today. Not in content, but I'm going to share a little bit more about me personally, because I feel as you go out into the parish or your ministry, however God chooses to call you in the ensuing years, your ability to be a human being is going to be more significant than your theological position. Now, I'll allow time at the end here for you to kind of challenge me and straighten out some of my own thinking about that. But your ability to be human and interact on a relational level with the people that are in care to you as the good shepherd in your ministry, I think will be the most significant aspect of your ministry. So Dean Smith graciously shared some facts about my history. A statistic I heard a couple of weeks ago, and I tucked it away, and I don't know where it comes from, but rather significant. 85% of those who go into ministry come from dysfunctional homes. I'm one of those people. And I would guess some of you in this setting, I'm not going to say all of you, but some of you, I would think, came out of a dysfunctional home setting. We're less than perfect. We're all under the need of grace. We have not been perfect people. God did not give us perfect parents, so there will be dysfunctions within our home. But 85% who choose to go into ministry come out of some severely dysfunctional family settings. I was one of those. Not as an indictment to my parents, but as a way of saying we as a family learned to grow together because of the circumstances we lived with. Let me highlight just a little bit what leads me to a ministry today. As I went through high school, I went through in 90, we had our 30-year class reunion, which was fascinating. Fascinating. I hope 30 years from now you can come back to the SEM and meet your classmates, because it's a wonderful experience in kind of resonating, how have you changed, even though everybody says, Merrill, you look just like you did 30 years ago. I thought, really? I look that bad? Receding hairline? It's a wonderful experience. When I was in high school, I talked to some of my friends I had not seen in 30 years. I said, how do you remember me? I was very conscientious, hardworking, rather athletic, captain of the tennis team, a nice person. I was liked by everybody, and I worked very hard at that. Not knowingly, but as I look back, nice person. So then I chose in high school that I wanted to go into ministry. And when I look back, I said, well, what was it about ministry that attracted me to want to choose that vocation? I think more than anything, it was because it was safe. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. So at least I knew I had grown up in the church, have very loving and, in a sense, traditional Missouri Synod parents going to church regularly. This is what I would do, and it's very predictable, and it's very safe, and it's secure. And I think it's a wonderful vocation. So off I go to Concordia St. Paul for 2 years. This is back when it was still a two-year college. And if I were to talk to some of my classmates, I think they would say, Merrill, very hardworking, very conscientious, tried pretty hard to get some good grades, usually B's. You know, I wasn't one of those Tom Manteuffel who was in my class getting all A's. Is Tom here? I hope to see him before I leave. Brilliant person. I love Tom. I've never told him that, but I always admired his ability to just plod along and do so well academically. Hardworking, but I always seemed to lack self-confidence. But nobody would ever know that. Nobody has ever told me that. I also had a sense of being rather self-conscious. A people pleaser. I think more than anything, one of my goals in life was always to please other people so that I would not create conflict or get a lot of negative feedback. And I think, again, looking back retrospectively, there was always a lot of loneliness, mostly because I didn't have the ability or the awareness to know what feelings I was experiencing as I went through college, let alone SEM. And if you're going to ever develop an intimate relationship with a spouse, with peers, you have to be able to share your own feelings and be aware of those. Didn't do a lot of that. So I come off to the SEM coming from Minnesota, the suburbs, come down to the big city of St. Louis. And as I continued in my seminary training, one thing began to develop in me was a sense of some self-doubts. Now, I got into the system and the track and continued to move along without ever stopping to say, is this truly something I want to do? Is this what God has called me to do? And inside I'm saying, well, maybe it's not. I don't know. So I continued, though it's a safe, it's predictable, and it's a very secure system. It's a wonderful system. But it also doesn't challenge you to say, is this what you want to design your life around? I know I had turned my life over to Christ. I had truly, in a sense, had a conversion where I believe in my being, my spirit, my soul, my heart. I had turned my life over to Christ, and yet there were still these lingering doubts. There still was this lack of self-confidence. There was this feeling of, at times, poor self-esteem, and I'm thinking, what is that all about? I'm praying daily with intent and meditation. I went to chapel, I think, more than anybody ever did at the SEM, bar none. I prayed I read scripture, and yet there was still something inside of me that felt broken, and I couldn't fix it. And I didn't have a clue what that was all about. Now, nobody would ever know that, because I never shared that. I wasn't aware of it, usually, and it was something that just kind of ate away at me. So, 24 years to this month, graduated from the SEM. Within 2 weeks, I got married, having met my wife on Vicarage in Chicago. If any of you are going out on Vicarage, that's the place. Look around, do your best, find that person. We met as a blind date. A little quick aside. We met as a blind date on the tennis team here at the SEM. Guy's married to a TWA stewardess. And I said, Joni, sometime when we get back on, when we're on Vicarage, both in Chicago, let me know. I'd love to meet a TWA stewardess. Okay? Wonderful fantasies. 9 months went by, nothing. Never heard from Joni. One day, she gives me a call and says, I gave enough your name to somebody. I said, fine. So I call her up, said, I'm Meryl. Okay. Would you like to go up? No, I'm going home to see my parents in Wisconsin. I thought, oh no. An only child, tied in, dependent to her parents, forget it, this is not for me. So I called 2 weeks later, said, Sharon, remember, this is Meryl. She says, who? Who is this? What do you want? I said, almost said, forget it. We got together, long story, a year to the day we got married, and it's been a wonderful 24 years of marriage. But I graduated from the SEM, went out to the first parish. Has anybody ever heard of Eden Valley, Minnesota?
Hey.
Raise your hand. Yes. How many people in the town?
Now, back then, probably 5 or 6,000, maybe less.
Eden Valley, not Eden Prairie.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Let's start over. How many have heard of Eden Valley? Zippo, 800. 800. So I'm going from all of this wonderful stuff from school to a town of 800. Within the first year of my parish experience, I was in marriage counseling. Part of it because of what I said before, I didn't know what was going on exactly. The parishioners would say, Merrill is a wonderful pastor. He's doing well. He preaches well. But inside of me, something just didn't fit. And all of my inadequacies, I think, got challenged by our marriage relationship where my wife is saying, why are you always out on the road with this two-point parish? You're always going everywhere helping all these people. And I'm saying, but Sharon, they need me. This is my call. And so I'm busy, I'm running around, and she says, yeah, but you're never home, we don't talk, we don't communicate. So I agreed under some coercion to go into marriage counseling. Wonderful experience. We tune up our car. I'm rather perfectionistic and compulsive. Every 15,000 miles I take my car in, get it fixed, get it checked, preventive maintenance. Every 3,000 I change my oil, etc. How many of us would ever think of having personal, emotional checkups like that in our life? We don't do that. I'm suggesting you think about that as God's preventive maintenance program for you, to sit down with somebody periodically to let them know what's happening in your life as a way of clarifying your own ministry and your own identity. So, 2 years into the parish, it's beginning to fall into place. I love hospital calls. So I had heard about CPE, so I took a unit at the University of Minnesota Hospitals with Ed Monkey, a great fatherly, grandfatherly figure within Missouri Synod. But he kept asking me questions about, like, Merrill, how do you feel? I don't know. This is new stuff. Some conflicts in the parish. How are you resolving that? How are you dealing with that? And I said, I don't know. It's tough for me. I don't want to deal with it. I forget. I try and walk away from it. He says, you can't do that. How does God want you to interact with these parishioners in a caring fashion, in a way to deal with these conflicts? So he began to open up all kinds of doors that I didn't know existed and challenged me to look inside of myself. But I love chaplaincy. So after 2 years more in the parish, I took a full year of residency at Lutheran General Hospital that really now forced me to develop my skills as a pastor. But the challenge and the twist I hadn't anticipated is how to use myself, my personal side, as a vehicle of God's grace with these human documents, with people in their lives, rather than giving them wonderful concepts, wonderful things. How do I give of myself? It was in that year that they then challenged me to look at my dysfunction of my father's alcoholism. I had never talked about that. The first person I admitted that my dad had a drinking problem was to Professor Stegemiller at Fort Wayne. And I began to look at that briefly and shut the door until I got into CPE. So you can see I'm going a long way to kind of set a backdrop here. So it was in CPE that they forced me to really challenge me to look at how I try and control my feelings, how I try and control relationships, how I tend to present an image of adequacy when inside I may not feel as adequate as I project. And they asked me to be involved in Al-Anon, which I'd never heard about, which is a self-help group for family members who are living with or have a struggle with a family who has alcoholism. I got involved in Al-Anon. It saved my life emotionally. And it was the first time, now here's where I get rather controversial, so as people listen to this tape, it was the first time I was able to sort out the difference between spiritual and religious, between spirituality and religion. The church, the seminary had given me a wonderful religious experience, but inside of me, because I felt something was broken, the religion was unable to fix. Al-Anon said, it's okay. You are accepted in your dysfunction. We know what that's like, and we accept you, we love you, and we care about you. And I began to develop an understanding of spirituality, which I'll talk about more, which brings us kind of as a... It helped me fix myself. It helped me fix me, if you will. Now, let me lead into some of the content then and kind of weave in some of the dynamics as it relates to me personally. The question I get asked most is I now, in a role of director of congregational services, I'm a resource to congregations in the Chicago area. 250 Missouri Synod churches alone in northern Illinois, 250 ELCA churches. How can anyone become addicted? We are so informed in our society today. We have so much knowledge about the ill effects of chemical use. How is it that someone, let alone a faith-committed Christian, could become addicted to alcohol and other drugs? It's related to three beliefs about our human condition. These are beliefs. I can't stand here and prove it with statistical background, but let me highlight three things about our human condition that set us up for the potential to become dependent on a range of things. One is that God has created us to live in relationship to ourselves, in relationship to one another, and of course in our relationship to God as we know Him in Christ. So within that relationship, I want to make sure I stay with my notes here so I don't get too far off the field. In that relationship, it also says that meaning and purpose and fulfillment in my life are directly proportional to the quality of the relationships in my life. When I'm isolated, when I'm lonely, when I'm depressed, I don't feel like life is very fulfilling and rewarding. I don't feel very close to other people. I feel rather lonely and isolated. The quality of my life is lacking. So it says then, meaning, purpose, fulfillment in life is dependent upon intimacy of relationships, which says God created us then to be dependent. All right? Think about that. I'll come back. The second belief about our human condition, not only have we been created to be in relationship to self, others, and God, as we know Him in Christ, He also has given us the ability to choose. We always have the ability to choose. To what degree do I wish to relate to you? I've known a couple of you. Charlie, I've known a few years. Others I've not known at all. And I then have the choice, how close do I want to get to relate to Russ today as he escorts me around? How long do I want to relate to this person or that person? We always have the ability to choose. But what I find in my life, and probably is true in yours, that as I relate to people, it's very easy for me to decide what's best for you, and I begin to kind of control some aspects about our relationship with you. No, you can't do that, I say to my son. He says, yes, I am. I said, no, you can't. I'm the dad. I've got the power. You can't do that. He says, oh, yeah? And he goes and acts out, and he gets his way anyway. It's very easy for us as parents to try and control our relationship with spouse, with kids, with parents, with neighbors, with colleagues. All right? So there's a second belief about our human condition. We have the ability to choose. Third is that yet as I have ability to choose, reality continues to challenge me. You can't have your way, Merrill. You are limited. You're not God yet. You are limited, and every time I try and think I want it my way, there's something that comes along and says, it can't be that way. Wouldn't you just love to have 72 degree days of sunshine with low humidity in St. Louis? You can't control that. You are limited. You can't change the past. You cannot predict the future. Otherwise, you would see a 55 million Illinois lotto winner standing in front of you. All right, if I could predict consistently the future. Two people won last week, so forget it. It's only 2 million this week. You cannot control people. You cannot change people. You can't change the past or predict the future. So, my point in all of this is there is a tension that exists in all of us, fallen creatures. That there's a strong part of that says of us that says, I want what I want when I want it. And if I don't get it, I will be frustrated, I will be angry, I'll be upset, and it creates kind of an internal tension. Because I want things to go my way. I want my kids to act a certain way. I'd love to have my spouse interact with me in the way I would love to have her support me. But on the other hand, there's a reality that says it can't be that way, Meryl. It just isn't. And once I continue to realize that's the way the world is, and that's not the way I'd like it to be, it heightens my own insecurity. It heightens the fact that I don't like being in a dependency in the fulfillment of my life because of these relationships. They're frustrating at times rather than rewarding and fulfilling. So the quest, the challenge to every one of us from a spiritual perspective is, how do we develop a lifestyle that creates a sense of serenity, a sense of inner peace, while we continue to struggle with the two dynamics that says there's a part of me that wants what I want and I will try and control other people, places, and things, while on the other hand, I continue to accept the reality that you can't, you are limited, accept reality the way it is. So when you've got those two poles, the challenge is how to live a lifestyle, how to develop a ministry that allows me to experience an inner peace. Not just a moment, but a style of serenity. That's the challenge. Now let me tell you a story that highlights these dynamics, and then I'll stop for a few minutes. The story is from Genesis chapter 2 and 3. Very familiar story. I'm not going to get into a lot of details. But listen to this story, maybe for the first time, from the perspective that highlights the dynamics, the spiritual dynamics of addiction. God places Adam and Eve in the garden and says, you now are able to roam, to experience your relationship together in a perfect fashion and in our relationship. But remember, there's only one thing I ask of you during this time in the garden. This, you see this overhead? That is now the tree of knowledge of good and evil. All right? Usually there's an artificial plant or something around that I can God says, see this tree? It's beautiful. It's just like every other tree in the garden. But by the way, I'm asking that you would not eat the fruit of this tree. So as time goes on, and here I get into some exegetical lukewarm waters here, so just bear with me in terms of intent rather than exegetical correctness. I would think Adam and Eve, as the time goes on, say, well, what's so special about this tree? What's going on? Along comes the serpent and says, Eve, you're no dummy. In fact, I bet you're rather intelligent. You look very vivacious, very young and bright. You know, you're no dummy. You know why God doesn't want you to eat the fruit of that tree? Because you will become like He is. The Hebrew says, you will become like the gods. You will be independent, self-sufficient, no longer dependent. You will be independent. You will be equal to God. You will, in fact, be God. Eve says, what? Grabs the fruit, eats it, gives some to Adam. He eats it, and instantly two things happen. They experience guilt. They transgressed their behavior. Their behaviors transgressed their value system. And secondly, they felt shame. It affected their self-image. That shame says there is something wrong with me as a person. I am no good now that I transgressed these laws of God. So the guilt is easier enough to deal with. You can share and talk about it, alleviate it. But shame takes years and years of talking and dealing with before you can equalize it. Instantly, two things happen. They go and hide. God in His daily walk says, what's going on here? I can't find you guys. Did you do something I asked you not to do? And notice this wonderful addiction response. Every alcoholic in the world has said this at one time or another. Says, God, Adam says, God, really, it's not my problem, God. It's that woman that you gave to me. If you wouldn't have screwed up by giving me this woman, I wouldn't be in this mess today. And he says, Eve, is this true? She says, God, hey, not my problem. It's that serpent that tricked me. God says, fine, that's it, I've had it, you're out of here. Consequences, no longer in the garden. You now have to work for a living, physical pain and childbearing, you're out of here. Consequences for your behavior. Now, here's the point. If you haven't heard anything up to now, listen to this. Anything out there that holds out the potential to make me feel more in control of my life, to make me feel more powerful, to lessen my anxiety, to alleviate my insecurity, to let me feel less anxious, to minimize my frustration, anything that does that holds the potential for me to become dependent upon it. Period. End of sentence. Anything that holds out that potential has the potential for us to become dependent upon it. So there's a range of things we can become dependent upon. Alcohol, drugs, are in the food classification. So food, money, power, sex, gambling, work, and relationships. All have the potential to bring imbalance into our life and cause dysfunction. Or as we can say it another way, to cause a lack of freedom to choose, because it then begins to control my life. So that left another concluding side to this that says, the person who is addicted to whatever is not less faith committed than I am or you are. They're not more psychiatrically impaired, not more psychologically screwed up. They are not more will-driven. They are not less hard-driving, thinking, creative, intelligent people. It simply says, over time, they have continued to use this substance and crossed over that invisible line from social recreational use into dependence and addiction and have created a chronic condition and cannot cross over that line again into social use. Can't do it. Millions try it and they go back to relapse and they keep using and they just can't do it. There are exceptions, and someone says, I drank 2/5 a day for 400 years. I stopped and went back to 1/5 a day and it hasn't gotten worse. I'll say, fine. I would like to know more about that history, but there are exceptions. But I'm saying, as a rule, once you cross over that invisible line from recreational social use and it has now become a dependency and led to an addiction, you cannot go back to social use again. The point, though, is anything that makes me feel more powerful, more in control of my life, less anxious, less frustrated, more secure, more less than shy, more self-confident, that I can get hooked on. There's a range of things. All right? So the classic definition of where is that line between use and misuse? Two basic rule of thumbs. One is that my inability to choose how much to use once I start using that substance. I'm going to stop off and have just one beer, and before long, all of a sudden, I've had 6-7 beers, and I only intended to have one. I've lost the ability to intend to use according to my plan. Loss of control. When I start, I cannot predict how long I will use or how much I will drink or use of that substance. Secondly, when it begins to affect any one major area of your life, you've got a problem. If my wife says to me, Merrill, your work continues to get in the way of our relationship. And I say, oh yeah, I'll cut down, I'll go to less meetings, I'll be less involved, do that, and I do it for a week and then I get back off. I've got a problem with work. For us as clergy persons, as caregivers, work is probably the most vulnerable area, and especially for us as clergy, that gets misused in a sense of the inability to set limits and boundaries. And it is difficult. It is very difficult, and there's no formula to figure that one out. You have to struggle in your own way, in your own setting, to keep that balance. But it's not unusual for people to become dependent on work. I love the feeling that people are calling me, say, we need you, Merrill. Can you come and help us? It feeds something inside of me that nurtures me, but there's an expense to be paid, and that's in the quality of relationships and the people around me, and I have to make some decisions about that. Now, has anybody got a hot question you want to ask as I take a break? Yes.
Your example with work there, is that then related to some imbalance within yourself, insecurity within yourself that feeds that drive then? Or
yes. Yes. Yes, I do. I think all of us, because of our old Adam, because of our sinful nature, because of our original sin, all of us share in imperfection, or we could say low self-esteem, feeling insecure. Some of us it's more intense, and other times it's more intense, and depends on stages in our life, whatever. Because of my parents' situation, who gave me as much as they could under their circumstances, I, as the oldest child, I feel I was not as nurtured to the degree that I would have liked or would have wanted to. And even though they never said it, I sometimes got the message, Merrill, you know, if you keep your room clean, we'll love you. Or if you don't swear, or if you act like a nice boy, we will love you. And so there would be times when I would not clean my room, or maybe say a bad word once in a while, or act out, and I'd say, see, I'm not loved. Not to their fault, it's just my interpretation. And so there's a number of circumstances then feed, see, and I look for those, and I get caught into a loop, not unlike the addictive loop, and I feed off the negativity until somebody can say, wait, stop, look at what you're doing, challenge my thinking, help me intervene in effect on that negative loop to help me get on a more positive side. Al-Anon helped me with that. We'll take one more, and then we'll, or two more. First gentleman here, and then one more, and then we'll move on, just because of the time frame. Yes?
The problem I have in my life is that I'm less patient, less compassionate, less tolerant of my immediate family than I am of those around me.
That is almost always correct.
I can't figure out why the ones that are the dearest to me, I treat the worst.
I can only speak from my own experience. It's the same thing in my life, that I tend to scapegoat family members, displace, psychological term, displace my whatever. I think the main issue surrounding that is the accountability. See, I supply preach on Sunday, and I've got about three wonderful sermons. But if you ask me for the fourth Sunday in a row, I'll probably turn you down. Because I've got three in the can, and if I go in the fourth one, it's not going to be as good as the other three, see? So my point is, maybe in a parish setting, whatever, you can be wonderful, you can be effective, you can be moving, you can be creative, but then you go home, you can do that for a day or two, but you live with these people day in, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they see your vulnerabilities. And the issue then I would say that you need to stop and challenge yourself with is, how can I deal with my own impatience, because it's my issue and it's my problem? What can I establish in my life as a system, as an ongoing system, to help me deal with my impatience so that when I am with my family, I am more relaxed, more caring, and truly can be giving to them rather than be impatient with their behaviors? One more?
Yeah, kind of a question, comment. You mentioned that an addiction, once you step over the social line to the addiction, it's impossible to go back.
Generally
true.
Yes.
Generally. The drug, alcohol, it's possible that you don't need that to live.
That's correct.
However, with food and work. So it's kind of a question, comment. How do you deal with it? And is that true? It's got to be much more difficult to deal with.
Food, I think, is more difficult. Let me ask in kind of a, coming to that question, what do you think is one of the most addictive drugs inherent as an addictive substance? Chocolate, I heard, or caffeine?
Sure.
Who said that? Bingo. Did you hear that? Nicotine, the most addictive substance, second to cocaine. Cocaine is a very wonderful drug. I mean, it'll get you into euphoria and a rush that you wouldn't believe. I'm not suggesting. But I'm saying it, the quicker response, the easier it is to get hooked on it. Nicotine. The recovering community tells me that it's easier to get off alcohol and other drugs than it is to get off of nicotine. To come back then to say, food and work challenge you to set up a system to keep a balance in your life. Because you have to eat. But then how you choose to eat, what substances you choose to eat, and the ritual around eating becomes very, very important, more so than quitting alcohol and other drugs. But with cocaine, you have to change your neighborhood, your friends, the triggers are so intense, you have to change the same system. But changing the system is only a piece. Unless you build up a more positive community relational support network, it is very easy to relapse on food, work, cocaine, other kind of inherently difficult substances because the imbalance is so strong. That's why the counter, the Al-Anon, the AA, the CA, NA, or OA for overeaters becomes very, very important. Work, there is a work addiction support groups as well. I can get into some of that at the end on resources. Let me highlight a couple things about intervention and then 12 steps. And then I'll open it up for just, I have some suggested books to read and then just open it up for general questions because this is meant to be only a primer. I'm only giving you a spoonful, hoping to challenge you to think about yourself and your setting that you're going into. And then through CEUs, Continuing Education Units, in our Synod, I hope you can learn more about addiction because I will guarantee you, you will face it if you're going into a parish. I was in Eden Valley, not Eden Prairie, for 4 years. Never had one alcoholic in the congregation until the last 6 months I was there. One guy's wife called and said, my husband's drunk in the barn, come and see him, which I did. I never realized there was alcoholism in that congregation because I'm in total denial. I'm dealing with some uncertainty, some doubts, some lack of confidence, whatever, so I'm not even looking for this stuff, let alone conflict. I'm saying to you, when you get into your parishes, if you do not find someone who's in recovery or struggling with an addiction or a family member in that first year, I think stop taking inventory of yourself because they're there. You're not finding them. And I don't mean go looking as a witch hunt, but they can be a valuable resource to you in the congregation. And there's a ministry available there that I think you can be a very effective vehicle in allowing God's grace to penetrate. Which leads us into intervention. The context for any intervention simply means addressing the reality of the situation to interrupt the process or the loop, the negative loop that gets started. Listen to this. Throughout the whole Old Testament, God continued to send prophets to say, you guys are... You're missing the point. You're worshiping the wrong God. And they say, oh, yeah, you're right. Oh, great. Thank you. And so they get back and worship the true God for weeks, months, maybe a couple of years, and then wander away because the sinful nature is so strong that they begin to wander after other idols. And God says, I don't give up. I'm very patient. I'm working a wonderful program. God says, I'll come again, send some more prophets. And they say, oh, thank you very much. This goes on for how many thousands of years in the Old Testament? The people never quite got it on the long run. Band-aid sort of thing. So God says, that's it. What am I going to do to wake this people up? So he says, I got it. I'm going to send my son, Jesus Christ. I'm going to come in the flesh and challenge them to look at their sinful nature and challenge them to make some choices in their life. God chose, because yet we were in our sins, to intervene on our behalf. That is the background for intervention process. So when I am caught in a loop, a dysfunctional loop, an unhealthy loop, I am in denial. Denial is the hallmark of a problem. Someone says, Merrill, they come to me and say, Merrill, we see that you have a tail behind you. I said, get out of here. If Russ told me that today, we just met, and he says, gee, I love your tie, nice suit and everything, but I noticed you got this tail. I say, who's this guy? He's got pre-Minnesota North blues. This guy's projecting all his problems onto me. So then I come and I see Dean Smith, and Dean Smith says, gee, Merrill, nice, glad to have you, but how come you're wearing this tail? I said, what are you talking about? Again, I can deny it. I'm saying, what does he know? He's never met me. Then I come into here, and all of a sudden, three or four or five of you are saying, this guy's okay, but what's with the tail? If three people tell you you've got a tail, you better start going around pricing saddles. You better start looking around for the best bargain on saddles. You get the point? If one person says you've got a problem with alcohol or drugs or work addiction or impatience or problems, I can say, get out of here. two people tell you, you can kind of begin to say, what's this all about? When three people say you've got a problem, you better take a hard, solid look at that. Psychic, emotional, physical pain, you name it. Until I want to change my behavior to alleviate the pain, I will never change my behavior. So, in an intervention process, it simply means you can do it on some informal ways in your congregations or with individuals, or you can do it in some very formalistic ways that would involve some professional people. Let me highlight for you what some things you can do if you're in a parish setting in an informal way. You can talk about chemical dependency and chemical dependency problems through your whole educational experience. You've got Sunday school. You've got Bible classes. You've got LWML groups. You've got all kinds of natural educational experiences in the parish that if you feel somewhat comfortable highlighting issues of dependency, addiction, you're already beginning to establish an atmosphere within your parish that says you have some knowledge, you're comfortable with the subject, and you're setting up an environment of acceptance. Nobody came out of the parish walls to talk to me about their drinking problems because somehow I'm communicating to them, don't come to me, I don't know what to do with it, I think it's immoral, I think it's a sin, I don't think I would know what to do with you, so don't come and talk to me. So they don't. So if you can create an educational climate that says you accept the reality of that, and people will begin to respond. Secondly, as you continue to preach about human pain, human dilemmas, the human characteristics that we all struggle with in vehicles of God's grace coming to us, you can at times highlight the issues of alcoholism, drug dependency, chemical dependencies, you name it. People will begin, when I preach, at times, if appropriate, I'll preach a sermon on alcoholism. Usually three things happen. One group, one third will totally fall asleep more than they normally do on a Sunday morning. They do not want to hear this. They don't know why I'm preaching about this. One third get agitated. I can actually see physically that they're sitting there, wringing their hands, and they're giving me these scowls, and they're saying, I don't know, this is totally inappropriate. Why is this jerk talking about alcoholism out of the pulpit? One third come out of service and say, thank you, Pastor. I'm a member of the fellowship. Nobody's ever talked about this. I really appreciate your understanding and support. It's creating an environment of saying that we as a caring community, I as the good shepherd of this caring community, have some concerns in the human range of problems. Listen to family members. In Sunday school, kids will tell you all kinds of wonderful things. If you're listening, I call it with a third ear, that's sensitive and kind of discerning. Listen to the family members as they talk in the LWM group or in the LLL men's group. Listen to what they're talking about. Behind that probably is some concern about an alcohol or drug problem. Include in the Sunday prayers those who are struggling with addiction and support for those in recovery. Don't have to name anybody. You say that, and if I'm in recovery, I'll say, wow, this pastor is really caring about us who are struggling with the addictions. Or if you're praying for people who are struggling with their addictions, and I may be kind of wondering about my own drinking or drug use, I'll say, ooh, maybe I ought to go talk to this guy about this. Literature was the last thing I highlighted. There's no reason why you can't. There's wonderful material around these days from a number of publishers to have something in the literature racks, in the narthex. It's again saying that we as a congregation are caring about you with a whole range. Now, I'm not suggesting you have one whole setup just for addiction alone. There's a range of human problems, conflicts, and dilemmas. Addiction can be one part of that. And you don't want to put it right by the door so everybody sees who's grabbing this literature. You set it off to the side somewhere. Keep it discreet. A lot of stigma and a lot of sensitivity about it. There is formal intervention that you've often heard about in using the Johnson model. Vern Johnson, Episcopal pastor out of Minneapolis, many years ago set up a whole model to use. It's a wonderful experience. I was the technical advisor that the LWML has put out a videotape, 28 minutes, called "One Carefully Hidden." Saw it yesterday for the first time. It will be available. Talks about the intervention process. When you're in a parish or any setting and you're concerned about someone who has an alcohol drinking or any range of addiction problems, contact a professional to help set up an intervention where in a loving, caring fashion you surround the person with significant individuals in their life, and you talk openly about your concerns, your feelings, and what you hope they would do as a consequence or as a result of their use. I'm not going to highlight that at all, other than it's very, when done correctly, very, very positive and almost 100% support and follow through in the care that's recommended. Now, let me talk a little bit about the 12 steps. Remember when I said before that I had a vague sense that something was broken in my life and I didn't know how to fix it? Even though I feel like I trust solely on the merits of Christ alone, prayer, scripture, something is still missing. The 12 steps are a piece to put that perspective back in place for me and I think for many other people as well. Because the 12 steps are based on biblical principles with Dr. Bob and Bill Smith. Back in 1935 in Akron, when they put these 12 steps, they were involved in the Oxford movement, a very fundamental Christian movement in England, and that they utilized some clergy in the area to put these 12 steps together. So they are a philosophy of living. And they originally, in the original 12 steps, had Christ as the God we understand, but chose to take it out after there was a lot of discussion because they're saying, we want to open this up to the broad range, open the doors wide to get people using these as a way of living rather than keep it restrictive and narrow. So they put in their God as we understood him. All right? Now let me highlight, unless you've used the 12 steps out of your own recovery, let me highlight these 12 steps and share with you how they in fact are rather spiritual. The first three steps simply say, the first one says, I can't. The second one says, God can, and step three says, why not let him? I can't, God can, why not let him? Here they are. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, or put in whatever the addiction may be, that our lives had become unmanageable. I can't. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. God can. Third then, made a decision to turn my will and my life, see, my will, that strong part of me, that ego, that omnipotence I want, says, turn that over. Surrender. Our lives are over the care of God as we understood him. God, I can't. God can. Why not let him? And then listen to these next steps that says, I looked in, I looked up, and I looked out. Remember relationships? God created us to be higher power God as we know him in Christ, peers, and self. Step four says, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, where you would sit down and write out for yourself a searching and fearless moral inventory. We would say theologically, confession. I look inside, admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Where once I take my inventory, I sit then with you and I begin to share that. Now, if you've not done that, that can be one of the most frightening things you do. I think it would be wonderful if Dean Smith and others, Charlie, prior to his retirement, would sit down and say, for every student prior to taking that first call, we would ask you to take a fourth and fifth step. You would take a fearless moral inventory of your life and you would sit down with another human being and share the exact nature of your wrongs. Whew. Ooh, major challenge. We look in. The next two steps says we look up. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, my impatience, you know, my insanity, my control, my all of that. I'm entirely ready to let God take those defects of character away. And step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. We look up for help. And the next two, we look out. Steps eight and nine, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. See, that you would sit down, I would with my family say, Sharon, let me share with you some of the things that I feel badly that have hurt our relationship. And step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So I look in my inventory, I look out, I look up, and then I look out. And then the last three steps, step 10, I look in again, I continue to take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Every day, I stop and take an inventory. The addicted person in recovery has to do that one day at a time. Every day. So I look in, and then the last, step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God
as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. So I look up, and then lastly, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I can't manage my impatience. I can't manage my control. God can. Why not let him? So I look in, I look up, I look out. I look in, I look up, I look out. The 12 steps of AA. They're a philosophy of living. And in Chicago alone, there are over 240 self-help, separate, distinct self-help groups. Because they have been so effective, because addiction is a spiritual paradigm, which means recovery is also a spiritual dynamic. It's a spiritual illness. So let me stop, and as we predicted, 45 minutes with some discussion. Here are some things you can do. Where do I have it? Here are some things not to do. Don't moralize. Don't nay. Don't preach. Don't point fingers. Don't say you should. You should be able to quit. You should be able to cut back. Don't moralize. It's an illness. 1956, the AMA said it's an illness. It's predictable. It's got the agents. You can diagnose it, and you can recover if you do intervention and get some medical help. Don't offer simplistic platitudes. Just do this. Just do that. It's more complicated. Do not confuse salvation with recovery. It's not uncommon for some people to say, just be saved. Just pray. Just let Christ work within your life. I'm saying, why not help the person get recovery, get the chemical addiction in balance, or under control, or arrested, and then help them deal with their faith commitment. Fourth is, don't try and do it by yourself. You can't cure it. You didn't cause it. You can't control it. So the last thing is help. Don't quit when you get resistance. When the denial, the minimizing, the rationalizing is there, don't get discouraged. Stick with them, him or her. So five things you can do. Learn facts about the illness. The best thing to do is go to some open meetings. Go to some open AA meetings. Get to know the resources in your setting as you get settled into your parishes or on vicarage. Find out what's available to you. Talk openly, as I said, within your parish setting. Refer in order that you can be a catalyst. You don't have to know all the answers. Just refer them. Get some help. Utilize recovering people. And fifth is allow meetings, self-help group meetings, in your parish, in your building. It's a wonderful message to say, we understand you can use our building. They'll pay you rent, in fact. They'll clean up behind themselves. And if you insist no smoking, no smoking. But allow them to come into your church setting. I've got some books that I think are wonderful resources. The two that I found lately to be very stimulating are Keith Miller. Keith Miller is an author. Many of you have heard of his other book, Drinking New Wine, or whatever. He's got a book here that talks about his own alcoholism and his work addiction. And so one is Hope in the Fast Lane, where he talks about sin as a sin disease. And then he's got a book on the 12 steps from a spiritual perspective, A Hunger for Healing, Keith Miller. Gerald May, many of you have heard of Rollo May of the Menninger Clinic. Gerald May's got a number of books. I like this one, Addiction and Grace. John Keller, who I've worked with for years, and his first book was Ministering to the Alcoholics. It's often used in pastoral care courses. He's got a new book out now, Alcoholics and Their Families, A Guide for Clergy and Congregations, an ELCA pastor. And then the last one, this has been around since the mid-80s, Steve Apthorpe, A Clergy Handbook on Alcohol and Substance Abuse. Let me stop. I'm open for comments. Now, if you need to leave, feel free to go. Yes?
We were talking before about dependency and independency, and I'm wondering if man can strive for independency, or do they need to choose their dependence? Where they look for their happiness?
That's an excellent question. We will we will never be independent because we have been created to be independency. The issue is, how do I maintain a balance within that dependency? So how do I build a system within my life to have an inner sense of serenity or peacefulness most of the time, so that I can, because I will be prone to get out of balance. So what can I establish? I can have a friend, or we would say a sponsor, that I can call anytime and say, look, my life is a mess, I can feel it out of whack, I'm getting feedback from my family, or the congregation is giving me messages, here's what's going on with me. Or you can be involved in a self-help group that seems to help balance that for you. Meditative materials are available. Always, though, I've found it has to be outside has to help me, because insight won't do it. If I'm feeling exceptionally guilty, guilt is a wonderful mechanism that God has created us with. It's simply something tells me something is out of whack in your life, so change it. Change your behavior so you don't feel so guilty. What happens, though, to the martyr is they let that guilt pile up, and it doesn't lead to any action, and they just get overburdened by it, and then they become the martyr. Guilt in God's creation is meant to spur us to change the behavior that's causing the guilt. So if I'm getting those feelings, I need to change my behavior in some way, to call somebody, to go to a meeting, to read some literature, to bring my life back in balance. Does that respond to that? So, independence, I have to take initiative, and in a sense that's kind of an independent, but what do I take initiative for, and what do I gravitate toward? Because I will always be dependent.
And I guess the follow-up question, I don't know, when we preach law, gospel, sermons,
yes,
and we're preaching the law against their unbalanced dependency,
yes,
are we going to say the gospel is a balanced dependency, or is it... I'm just trying to relate this more to...
In a theological framework. You must have law. I mean, because that's what challenged me. That's confrontation. That's intervention. How I deal with it and how I frame it and how I phrase it and how I articulate it is important. But you need to have that confronting my imbalance. Christ's response to me in grace is the starting point. I'm saying it's not all in all. It is. But can that also be balanced with other kinds of relationships? My church involvement, but I may need, and maybe I can get everything met within that church in terms of that balance factor, but maybe I need to go outside of the church in some other program to help me in maintaining a balance. The only reason I believe it, and an editorial comment, the only reason I think AA got started is because we in the church defaulted our role as an accepting, caring community. If we, across the board of denomination, whatever denomination, says we bring you in, we accept you, we understand dysfunction, we care about you because Christ has embodied himself to reach out in ministry, and we live that, AA would not have, there would have been no place for it. The church hasn't done that for whatever reason. That's another whole lecture. And so now we have to figure out how do we work jointly. I think the 90s, I'm getting editorialized very much here. In the 90s, small group, support group ministry is going to be the growing way to reach people in a caring community. Willow Creek Community Church outside of Chicago, the fastest growing church in the United States, 12,000 people show up on a Sunday morning. They have got it down to a perfection how they have small group ministry outreach in embodying the gospel then in a caring fashion in a small group setting, so people feel cared about. Yes?
My question is an information question. Is there some, statistically speaking, significant difference between this alcohol and the drug abuse problems between the so-called religious people and the Christian
yes.
people and non-Christian people? That's one question. And the other one is the difference between Christians and the Lutherans, all the same. I mean, how is it?
Lutheran and other Christians?
That's right. And the first question is un-Christians and Christians.
Yes. To your first question, yes, there are statistics. And the statistics tend to show that those denominations that forbid alcohol use, when the members use, have a high incidence of alcoholism. Mormons, high incidence of alcoholism. Seventh-day Adventists, high incidence of alcoholism of those who drink. Okay? Also, within the Christian denominations, there's the Irish curse. The Roman Catholic Irish high incidence of alcoholism. Chicago, that's what keeps us in treatment. It's all our wonderful brothers in the Catholic faith, all our Chicago policemen. Because they have, drinking is a part of their history, but drunkenness is supported. And so there's a high incidence of alcoholism. Lutheran versus other Christian, no. There are no statistics, to my knowledge, that have separated those groups to compare. I would say within Lutherans and Missouri Synod, they would run the general statistics of population generally, which would be 7 to 8 who drink have a high incidence of leading toward alcoholism. Okay.
You commented that you would speak to the difference between spirituality and religion. Mm-hmm. I think among AA circles, religion, there's a real strong anti-clericalism. The idea that the church is nothing but an assembly of hypocrites talking about highfalutin notions, what have you. And spirituality, sure, they do offer respect to a belief in Jesus Christ, but that's your interpretation as God, as you understand him. And as a pastor who we're being taught that law and gospel will apply to any situation, and we are being taught that there is but one God on this earth, and that is Jesus Christ. It's a real personal question to me, because my brother's a drunk, and he's been sober for a couple of years now.
Great.
And he wants absolutely nothing to do with the church, and that comes out of his experience, because while he was in the midst of dysfunction and while he was in the midst of his addiction, that's how the church looked to him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
How do I reach that person?
Okay. There's a number of ways to answer that. One, I would say very clearly, being a part of a self-help group does not lead me to be saved. Okay? As we know it, salvation comes through Jesus Christ. So the intent of the self-help groups is not salvation.
Right.
So, and the intent was, let's get these folks sober and get them thinking and emotionally together so that they can make some choices and decisions. So my response would be, hang with your brother. If the church has been meaningful in the past, he still may not be in a place of embracing it because of what it embodied to him when he was using, and he felt maybe more law than gospel. But if he continues in recovery, in a good program of letting go, surrendering, there's a high likelihood, I'll say categorically, when a person is in recovery, if they were members of the church and involved in the church, there's a high likelihood they come back into the church. That's been my experience as a pastor from a treatment segment. They do come back, but maybe it takes a while because there's so much in the way for them to work through even getting their life back together. So I would say be tenacious, stay with them, be caring, reach out to him when appropriate, help him look at that dynamic. But it is true. It's a real dilemma as a pastor how to reach the person. And I would say go gently and be patient and give it some time, because it takes at least a couple, 3 years. However long they've been working, the illness has been in control, 2, 3, 5, 10 years. It's going to take 2, 3, 5, 10 years to get the recovery process in place. Question back behind you. Yes.
You talked about food addiction.
Yeah.
Alcohol addiction.
Yes.
Work addiction.
Yes.
Then you mentioned some others.
Sex.
Sex.
Money.
Money.
Gambling. Power.
Power.
And relationships I often throw in there.
Is there anybody not addicted?
I mean,
as we look out.
I met one once. He or she's not in this room. Yeah, I know. It's
I know that's
the point is, and there's a difference between dependence and addiction. Addiction means that there's an inherent addictive substance that when I remove myself from it, I experience withdrawal. So like alcohol, if I build up a tolerance and I go cold turkey, I will have the shakes or something. That's an addictive substance as opposed to dependence. I'm dependent upon it, psychologically dependent. Okay? Yeah, I know. And Keith Miller just talks about we're caught into the sin disease. And I think sin very much parallels the dynamics of addiction. So in a sense, we're all caught into the original sin that we have the potential for imbalance. So I'm just challenging you and all of us, as I've been challenged, what are the tendencies in my life toward getting imbalanced? And how do I... So I say I'm in recovery, but are you addicted? No, I mean... But see... So yeah, I would reframe it though to say, yeah, we all have parts of our life where they get out of imbalance, whether that's you're addicted or dependent. Don't worry about it. Just find ways to keep yourself in good balance. One more and it'll be 11:30.
Appreciate you coming, Dave, and spend your time with us and help us. I've really struggled with this, and I want to do everything I can as a pastor to help people with addiction. I was wondering, and if you could help me resolve a tension, reconcile care that points the people to systemic behavior modification, 12 steps, self-help books, whether to point them there or to rely on something that has totally different presuppositions in many cases in terms of God's faithfulness through his means
yeah.
of grace.
Yes.
And I see the first as being valuable as a tool in the law domain in peeling back the layers of the onion, but I don't see an answer in that.
I agree. The answer to that, from my perspective, is timing. What does this person or family need at this time? And if it's crisis and the illness is in control, I would help them get medical attention or treatment or intervention or help or materials in the self-help realm first and stay with them, and then also work in the faith commitment, the challenge of Christ as their Savior, and stay with them through that process. If you come at them first with are you saved and how does Christ interact in their life and through the gospel, the illness is still in so much control, they don't see it, they don't feel it, they don't hear it. So it's a timing issue, not which is right or wrong. So get them in, get that illness in remission, and then bring the two together. Self-help groups are not the answer from a spiritual perspective. It's a start. You need to blend both of them. Now, I do wish to honor the 11:30 commitment. I've got a card. I hadn't thought of this, but if you have any interest to give me a call at some point, no matter where you are in the United States, I've got a card. I wish you God's richest blessing in your calls and your ministry, even if you're in first and second year, you need it just as much. All right? So go on to victory. I can't tell you what a privilege it is for me to be here the first time in 24 years to come back on campus and to worship with you. Thank you very much.